Welcome to the teaching podcast of Wellspring Church in New York City. We are a community that seeks to live in the way of Jesus and hope that you will be encouraged by today's teaching.
Give it up. Good morning. So like we begin every sermon in this Sozo series, we're not going to begin with a message. We're going to start like Jesus so often started, with the table, with a meal, as we lean into sozo, which is a full embodied wholeness, healing, salvation, forgiveness, freedom, deliverance, restoration. So, before any exhortation or teaching, light breakfast. I want you to think about something before we go to the table. Oh, look at it. I got double water. It's great. Look at this. God's already doing a double portion. We're going to study Peter this morning. He's a disciple of Jesus. If you're not familiar with him, he's wonderful, he's awesome, and he's also failed big time. And then he was restored. But I want you to think about this. The Lord knew all this. The Last Supper, where we get this practice of communion, came before the cross and before his failure. So that means Jesus fed Peter, the man that failed him. And he fed Peter before Peter failed him. He broke bread with the man he knew was going to deny him. He poured wine out for the one who was going to say, "I don't know you. I never knew the man." And I just share that because that should inform how we come to this table. We don't come because we got it all right this week. We don't come because you prayed enough this week, or you resisted enough temptation this week, or that you performed well enough this week. We come to this table because Jesus invites us to the table, already knowing everything. It's not for the impressive. No, you're all pretty impressive. It's for the hungry. So right now, with that in mind, can we stand? And as we've been teaching ourselves to do, just remember, your spirituality is not apart from you, your body, your breath, how you're feeling, your mind, your brain, your heart, your soul. So just pay attention to that. Remember that. Right? You're standing on concrete. You're breathing semi-clean New York City air. We have a filtration system. You're human. And you're coming to the table to have a sacrament that God gave us that's not abstract. It's actual bread. It's actual juice. He gave this act to his disciples. And he said to them, "This is my body, like take it, eat it, it's given for you. This is my blood poured out for you, drink it, take it in, let us become one." So let's take some time now and go to our stations. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Take the bread, dip it in the juice, receive the body of Christ. So as you're finding your seat and settling back in, I want you to keep focused on that wine-dipped, juice-dipped piece of bread you just ate. Because that same bread that you just received was once placed in Peter's hands. Peter held the bread. He looked at Jesus face to face to receive it. And he received his broken body and blood. And I believe in that moment, receiving the very first communion, that Peter felt love and he felt loyalty. And he had a faith that was filling him with all of his might. And yet he would deny Jesus 3 times, swearing that he didn't even know him just a few hours later. The Lord's table has always been a place for the overconfident and the ashamed, the faithful and the failures. And Peter was all of those things, just like all of us. So let's talk about Peter today. I love Peter. Peter is bold. He leads with his heart. Lots of times he leads with his heart right on his sleeve, which is kind of refreshing, very accessible. He's not false. He's passionate. He is bold. He's also a bit impulsive. But he's the one who left the nets immediately and went to follow Jesus. Like, dropping this life, I'm going after this. There's something compelling here, and I'm in. Peter was the one, the only one, by the way, of the disciples. When Jesus is walking on water, he jumps out of the boat and he walks on water with Jesus. Peter was the first one to declare to Jesus, "You are the Christ, the Messiah." Peter is the one who says, "Even if everyone else falls away, I never will." Peter did not walk in insecurity. He walked in bold confidence. He walked in big faith. He didn't always get it right, but he was all in. He believed deeply and loved sincerely. And yet, he denied Jesus three times, collapsing into failure at the peak of their mission. Like, at the moment. See, sometimes, because of this big failure of Peter and his denial, he gets portrayed like he had weak faith, like he collapsed at his weak faith, like it couldn't hold up under pressure. I don't think weak faith was his problem. I don't think there was anything wrong with his love and his devotion. I think Peter's view of sozo, of salvation, was too limited. Peter loved Jesus, but he overestimated himself. Peter believed in the Messiah, but he believed at least equally, if not more so, in himself. He believed his devotion was enough to stay rooted. He believed his zeal was enough to overcome. He thought his willpower was strong enough to resist. But when real pressure came, his self-salvation tendencies collapsed. And that is the gap we've been speaking about throughout this series. The gap we've been saying between the self that we present and even the self we actually believe in at times, and the self that shows up under fire even when we least expect it. And when that gap between the perceived self and the real self gets exposed, which is okay, by the way, in that gap comes shame, comes pain, and comes disqualification. See, most shame isn't born out of rebellion. Most shame, I believe, is born out of surprise. Out of that moment you find yourself saying, "I didn't think I was capable of that." And it's in that moment that your self-identity starts to collapse. I find most people in the place of lingering shame aren't struggling with rebelling against God or even necessarily deconstruction. They're struggling with the disqualification of themselves. That you love Jesus. You mean it. You really do. And you're sincere. And then something exposes the gap. A failure, a denial, a compromise, a moment or even a whole season in your life that you just didn't think was possible for you. You went down a path that seemed totally out of character for you. The way a relationship ended up ending, the way you treated your kids, the way you got ahead at work, things you said, things you did. And that shame voice starts to come and it says you had your shot and you missed the mark. You failed. And perhaps you go through some work and you know you can be forgiven. Or you even have been forgiven. Like, you've received that forgiveness, either from others and from the Lord. And yet you still feel tainted or unusable, not worthy or as valued. You're welcomed, sure, you know that. But maybe not wanted or needed. You may even recognize that you do have a seat at the table. You know you had a seat at the table this morning. Welcome to the communion table. And you receive communion with God. But you know you're not really like a leader. I mean, why should anybody listen to you? What have you got to say? You're no polished up Christian. You're not someone to look up to or of great value in the kingdom. You're just happy to still be welcomed. But that's just not the story of Jesus. That's not the message of the gospel, because the gospel and the sozo, the salvation that Jesus came to bring, is so much bigger than forgiveness. And don't get me wrong, forgiveness is really, really sweet. But this is what we see woven through John 21 and Luke 22 in the story of Peter. Jesus doesn't just forgive Peter, he restores Peter. He doesn't just welcome him, he commissions him. He doesn't just accept him, he entrusts him. That's sozo. And so this morning, what we're going to do is we are going to journey with Peter and we're going to go in deeper. And as we do, I want you to ask yourself something. Is your vision of salvation or sozo over you, your life, your body, your story, big enough to redeem all of your worst moments? Or are you believing in something smaller? Because Peter's story isn't just about failure. It's about the kind of salvation that he thought Jesus was giving and the way bigger one that Jesus was actually offering. And it's often in our very lowest moments that we find the deepest healing and the call of Jesus on our lives. So we're going to go back and we're going to go deeper. Cool? I'm going to cough and then we're going to invite the Spirit again. Oh, Lord, speak through me, through my very human weakness. We invite you, Holy Spirit, to come even closer. Come, Lord. The author and perfecter of our faith. Amen. I think if we're honest, Peter's story kind of unsettles us, not because he failed, but because we see ourselves in him. I've yet to meet a person who doesn't identify with Peter in some way. Because Peter didn't fail, like we're saying, due to a lack of love. He failed because he believed in a salvation that wasn't big enough to hold his weakness. So when his weakness was revealed, he fell into shame. And that empty ache that so many of us walk with is that gap, as we said, where shame resides and begins to take root. Peter believed, as I think probably many of us do that say yes to Jesus, that Jesus could save Israel. Perhaps Jesus could save the entire world. He just didn't quite believe that Jesus could save him from himself. The real crisis that we're going to look at in Peter's story is not his denial. It's his moment of denial that tried to rename him. His failure tried to become his identity. This is what the enemy always wants to do, which is why we're leaning so heavily into this morning. The enemy wants to render you useless. Therefore, he will try time and again to take your worst moments and paralyze you, to pull you away from your calling, to pull you away from your identity, and to just destroy your self-worth. So I'm going to look at Peter's story through four movements today. And we're going to go deeper. Act one, the man who would never. Have you ever overestimated yourself? Okay. This will get you in really big trouble in athletics. I can tell you this personally. I'm constantly overestimating myself on the basketball court. I can talk a big talk, and in fact, that's probably my primary athletic skill. But when it comes to basketball, I do have a secret weapon, and that's my good buddy Ben Bishop. Where are you at? Okay, so I can't tell you how many times I've talked a really big game out on the courts, done a pickup game, and got us into an all-out battle with a lot of hype built up on it. And then guess what? Ben comes through. He saves my bacon. He backs up my big talk. He gets us out of that battle because he scores a bunch of buckets. With Ben on my team, I've won a lot of games. And I've been able to boast in my weakness, which is my jump shot, because he's with me. Now, that's a bit of a trivial analogy, of course, though deeply personal to my life. But it gets exponentially deeper, of course, when we start to see the power of our overestimation and self-salvation tendencies thinking about our spiritual journey. Because we're not just talking about losing basketball games, obviously. We're talking about losing our identity, losing our self-worth, losing the very ground that we rooted our belief in the first place, like your initial roots, your initial grounding. Again, I don't think Peter had a faith problem. I'll say that again and again. I believe his faith was awesome. I admire his faith, his brazenness, his passion. I mean, he's like, Jesus, if you just call me, I'll join you out on the water. I love that. I want that faith. And when Jesus began to talk about suffering and death, Peter pulled him aside and rebuked him. That's bold, but he did, which is wild. But that also shows us when he rebukes Jesus in this moment, it's that Peter thought he understood the kingdom. He thought he understood himself, and he wasn't afraid to put it out there. I do love that. Peter was devoted. When others walked away from Jesus in John 6, Jesus turns to the 12 and he asks, do you want to leave too? And Peter answers, Lord, where else would I go? He's not posturing, he's devoted. He believed Jesus had the words of life. If we're honest, Peter isn't the weak Christian in the story throughout the narrative. He's the strong one, the one most of us would aspire to be. This will bring us up, though, to the Last Supper, where the story starts to really come to a head. After the bread was broken and the wine was poured, Jesus shares something deeply unsettling to his disciples. He turns to his disciples and he says, all of you will fall away. And of course, Peter, of the 12, responds immediately to this and says, even if everyone else deserts you, I never will. But let's let that line sink in a little bit deeper. Think about it again. Even if everyone else falls away, I never will. Peter isn't founding his faith in his own love of Jesus alone. He's saying he loves Jesus more than everyone else does. There's always been a need to compare, to measure up, mixed in with Peter's spiritual journey. In the midst of his devotion, he's wanting to be sure he is the most devoted, that he belongs and is doing it all right. Now, that doesn't mean his devotion is fake. I believe for him, he was being sincere. He stood on certainty of his loyalty. He stood on the certainty of his love being strong. But see, Peter was still believing that the human strength undergirded the kingdom. So then Jesus says something back directly to Peter. I tell you the truth, Peter. This very night, before the rooster crows twice, you will deny me three times that you ever knew me. To which Peter responds with a statement that I believe echoes through the entire story. Even if I have to die with you, I will never disown you. Peter's confidence wasn't fake, it was misplaced. He believed his devotion would carry him through. And that's where his gap begins. The gap between who he believed he was and who he discovered himself to be in the face of fear. I imagine every one of us here in this room has some I never, I will never sentences. I will never say that. I will never do that. I will never cheat. I will never steal. I'll never compromise that way. I'll never become that kind of person. Peter isn't the villain in the story. He's the mirror. Peter loved Jesus. Peter followed Jesus. Peter believed in Jesus. He had just not yet discovered that he still was relying on himself. And sometimes the only way we discover the truth about ourselves is in the height of pressure. And that's what's about to happen for Peter in just a few hours, standing in the courtyard, warming himself by a charcoal fire. Act 2, the fire of shame. The night that Jesus gets arrested in the Garden of Gethsemane is a chaotic scene. right? There's torches and there's shouting. There's confusion. There's betrayal. Peter draws out a sword, still trying to prove his loyalty and his strength, ready to fight. But Jesus stops it because Jesus is leading a bigger story. There is a bigger sozo at hand. The soldiers take Jesus. Everything seems now to be even more chaotic. This whole plan, this whole mission is crumbling. How could this be happening? The disciples are wondering, what has this all been for? Is this really how this is going to end and play out? And Peter follows behind, watching as Jesus is beginning to be chastised by the religious elite and the officials. He's being accused and he's being struck in the face, it says, repeatedly as he gives his answers that they don't want to hear. Luke 22 specifically says Peter followed at a distance. He's no longer beside Jesus, which is interesting. That distance means something because usually our courage fades slowly. First we follow at a distance, then we start to warm ourselves at the wrong fire. John's gospel tells us that it was a cold night that night. And so Peter does what any one of us would do. He steps close around a fire that's built in the courtyard. And here's where it kind of starts to unravel for him. The atmosphere is tense, as you can imagine. The courtyard's dim. Try and place yourself there. The middle of the night. Servants are probably moving around. People are being questioned. This is the courtyard of the high priest. The religious elite are there. High officials are there. Even a few soldiers are around. And the charcoal fire is burning. Peter stands there with his servants leaning in, warming his hands, probably trying to act like he belongs there, trying not to be noticed too much, trying not to be too conspicuous. The accusations of Jesus are taking place right over his shoulder. Jesus being repeatedly accused, wrongfully, struck in the face. And then someone looks a little closer through the fire and says, "Aren't you one of his disciples?" And Peter answers pretty quickly, I'm not. And a few minutes passes, and then another voice around the fire says, "You were with him." Peter says, "No." Jesus gets hit again. You can almost feel the panic starting to rise in Peter. The longer he's staying by this fire, the more exposed he's starting to feel. Then someone else finally speaks up and says, "No, didn't I see you with him in the garden?" And at this time, Peter swears, "I don't know the man." And silence. And in the silence after that statement, a rooster begins to crow. And Luke tells us something that almost feels unbearable when you read it. Right in that moment, Jesus turns across the courtyard, across the firelight, over the sound of the rooster crowing, and looks into the eyes of Peter. And in that moment, Peter realizes something he never imagined possible. He is capable of denying the one he loves the most. And he runs out into the night, weeping bitterly. Because Peter didn't just fail, he discovered that he was not who he thought he was. And that's the birthplace of shame. It's not just I did wrong, but maybe I am wrong. I mean, guilt is one thing. In guilt, you feel and know that you messed up. But shame starts to tell you this is who you are. That's the shift Peter is feeling as he runs out into the night, picturing that moment, looking into Jesus' eyes as shame is starting to overcome his body. Because you see, a big part of shame is relational rupture. And he created that rupture with Jesus. It's the internal experience of, I've just broken something I can't repair. And he's running. Peter doesn't just hear the sound of the rooster crowing. He's hearing the verdict start to rise from inside of his own heart, saying, "What have you done? You said you would never. You're not the man you thought you were." And as that verdict starts to settle into him, something begins to die. But it's not his faith. It's not his love for Jesus. It's his own personal identity. Peter's identity before this moment was, even if all fall away, I will not. He had certainty in his faithfulness. He was loyal. He was brave. He was a good man. You see, failure doesn't just expose our sin, it shatters our self-image. The failure wasn't just about sinning for Peter. His view of self was destroyed, and that's where sozo has to reach for all of us. It has to get to our view of ourselves. I imagine many of us have had our own courtyard moments, a moment where something came out of us that we didn't think lived inside of us, a boundary line we thought we would never cross. And suddenly that question isn't just like, what did I do? The question is, who am I really? This is what Peter is sitting with. It's what we all sit with in moments like this. And I say all because all of us will or have made mistakes that we never thought we would. We are all human. We are all fallible. We all fall short of the glory of God. But there is sozo, and it is deeper and it's wider than you think. Act 3, gone fishing. After this moment, we don't actually hear a lot from Peter. In the narrative, we later find out he's decided to go back to fishing. And Peter going back to fishing is not random. It's not that he just didn't know what to do with himself, so he goes fishing. Being a fisherman was his pre-calling identity. Who was Peter before becoming a disciple of Jesus? He was a fisherman. This is what shame does. It makes us go back to the place that we last felt competent. We retreat to what feels safe. Peter's failure didn't mean he quit believing in Jesus. It reveals that he quit believing in himself. Let me say that again. His failure didn't mean he quit believing in Jesus. He quit believing in himself. No longer usable, certainly not able to lead, and at best he should just humbly serve and stay out of the way. This is what happens when shame warps our identity, when we've not experienced sozo in those deep places where our shame resides. And it's tricky because you still love Jesus, as Peter did. And you can still love Jesus, hear this, and not be healed from shame. You can still know and experience that you're forgiven, yet internally you still feel disqualified. That's because it's not a salvation problem, it's a shame problem. And the sozo of Jesus Christ is not just unto salvation from sin, but to the full eradication of shame. So we're great at naming how Jesus went to the cross in the church and put a death blow to sin. But as Hebrews 12 reminds us, for the joy set before him, he endured the cross. What? Scorning its shame and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured such opposition from sinners so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. Wellspring, Hebrews 12 is reminding us, do not lose heart. Jesus came not just for your sin, but to heal you from shame, to reinstate you as a son and daughter, to give you a robe and a ring, and to welcome you home. But Peter isn't there yet. He's fishing, back on the boat, working hard, casting nets, pulling them in through the night. Empty nets, by the way, no fish. Almost an identical narrative to when we first met Peter. And I love this. The text says, at daybreak, Jesus shows up. At the dawning of a new day, there is the Lord standing on the shore, and he's coming to Peter. Peter went back to fishing, but Jesus wasn't finished with him. And if you have ever slowly backed away because of shame, I think this part of the story is particularly for you. Why? Well, this has been hitting me all week. We kind of led this series and we talk about this key verse, the declaration of Jesus. He comes onto the scene. The Son of Man came to do what? Seek and save the lost. Seek and sozo the lost. We've been obviously focusing on sozo, but what was the first thing he came to do? To seek. Jesus is in pursuit of you. He's standing at the shore of your heart, not to condemn, but to bring sozo because you're precious to him. And so here he comes and seeks out Peter. Peter wronged him, but where's the Lord? Seeking him. And so Jesus stands at the shore and he calls out Peter and the others and he calls them friends. And he leads them into another miraculous catch of fish, just like he did when he first met them. And Peter recognizes that this is the Lord. He throws off his robe and he just dives into the water. At the sight of Christ's pursuit of him, shame isn't making him run away anymore. It's making him desperate, perhaps to say, I'm sorry, I don't know. Perhaps to get there before the others, just to clarify what happened. Perhaps to grovel. We don't know exactly, but he swims with all his might to the shore as hard as he can. He gets there before the others, and he finds himself standing there face to face with Jesus again, looking into his eyes, across the flames of a charcoal fire that the Lord has prepared on the beach. You can almost feel the thickness in the air, rivaled probably only by the thickness of the tension starting to rise in Peter's body. His whole body and being, I imagine, right there in that moment, are being reminded of the last time he stood across a charcoal fire, looking into the eyes of the one he betrayed. This moment is not an accident. In fact, even John, the author, underscores this moment with a very strong literary parallel. The Greek word John used for the fire that Jesus made on that beach is this word, anthrakia, which means a charcoal fire or a fire of coals. And what's important to note is that this word only appears twice in the entire New Testament. Both of them are in the Gospel of John. By the way, John did not have to use this word. There are lots and lots of words that can be used for fires and bonfires, but he chose this very specific word about a charcoal fire, fire of coals, and he only uses it twice ever, at the fire where Peter betrayed Jesus and at the fire on the beach of his restoration. Do you see it? The same eye contact, the same flickering light. Can you feel it? The same two people? Can you smell it? The smoke? The charcoal? Neurologically, scent is uniquely powerful. Our sense of smell actually connects directly to our limbic system, the part of the brain that's actually responsible for emotion and memory. It bypasses, actually, some of our cognitive filters, which means you can smell something and instantly be transported. A hospital hallway. A perfume. Your grandma's kitchen. A charcoal campfire. The body remembers even before the mind explains it. Peter's body would have remembered that first fire. The smell of burning coals. The smoke in the air. The heat on his face. The adrenaline in his chest, all of that would have stuck in his nervous system. Shame isn't just theological, it's embodied. It lives in the body. So this moment on the shore with Jesus standing across at anthrakia is not just happenstance. It's not a neutral detail. It's a trigger. And I don't believe Jesus is accidentally recreating the sensory environment of Peter's worst moment. I believe he's doing it intentionally. Why? Because healing often requires revisiting, but with a different outcome. This is actually how trauma therapy works. Safe re-exposure, but with a different relational experience. Jesus is recreating the environment of failure without creating condemnation. This is trauma-sensitive restoration. It allows the brain to rewrite the emotional meaning of a particular event. So Peter denied Jesus at a charcoal fire. Now he stands at a charcoal fire. And instead of accusation, he receives loving eye contact, breakfast, gentle questions, and commissioning. The shame memory is being rewired in Peter. This is sozo. It goes all the way to the deepest parts, our hearts, our minds, our soul, our nervous system, our bodies. Sozo is freedom from shame. So sozo is not, let's pretend that bad thing never happened. It's not, let's just try not to think about it anymore. Sozo is Jesus saying, let me meet you there. let me meet you in the rupture, in the trauma. Let me walk you back through it safely and redeem it so that you never have to suppress it again. Jesus does not heal Peter by pretending that fire never happened. He heals him by lighting another one. That's how sozo works. Jesus does not erase the memory. He redeems it. And I love this. What does Jesus do next? Classic Jesus. He feeds Peter. They have a meal together. Breakfast before conversation. Highly recommend that, by the way. But notice that. Jesus doesn't begin, "Hey, Peter, let's talk about what happened." He begins with, "Come and have breakfast." Or shame expects interrogation. It expects punishment. It expects penance. But Jesus offers nourishment. Before Peter explains himself, before he promises to be better, before he's recommissioned, he's fed. That's sozo. Jesus restores Peter's body before he restores his calling. Look at this, John 2:21-9, we see this, that Peter and the others reach the shore. Jesus already had breakfast cooking on the shore. Fish on the fire, bread ready to go. But in the very next verse, he says, "Bring some of the fish you've just caught." So read it with me, John 21. I love this little thing in there. And when they landed, they saw a fire of burning coals, the anthracia there, with fish on it and some bread. Jesus said to them, "Bring some of the fish you have just caught." So Simon Peter climbed back into the boat and dragged the net ashore. It was full of large fish. What's Jesus up to here? He doesn't need their catch. He already has fish on the fire. Why ask for the fish? He's inviting Peter to participate again and to take part in his own restoration. Jesus is subtly saying, "Hey, what you have to offer still matters. You have a place at this fire and in this work." You see, shame leads to disqualification. Oftentimes it makes us feel like we don't belong anymore, but Jesus is demonstrating the opposite. He's restoring Peter by giving him a role again. Not because Jesus needs help, because Peter needs re-inclusion. And Jesus wants him to be part of it. Jesus didn't need Peter's fish, but Peter needed to know he still had something to bring. This is how sozo works. Not just forgiveness, but reintegration. And all over a meal. Throughout scripture, meals mean peace, reconciliation. They mean covenant. They mean family. Jesus is restoring the appetite of Peter, the very thing that often gets taken away in our shame. And he's restoring his sense of belonging. Jesus is meeting Peter's humanity before he addresses his failure. "Peter, you are a human being with needs. Peter, you're still worth being cared for. You're welcomed around my fire. You're welcomed at my table. And you have something to offer the table." There's a subtle nod to the Eucharist there, to communion. Peter being restored at the table of the Lord. I think it's interesting, this progression of restoration we're seeing by the resurrected Christ, by the way, a pretty good model to follow. Oftentimes in church, we think restoration starts with confession. Confession's very good. So healing. But I think the cross and resurrection actually invites us to a deeper, more embodied understanding of restoration, especially in areas of deep wounding, trauma, and shame. In this story, we see this progression I just want to highlight for us of Jesus first restoring Peter's body. Then he restores his sense of belonging. Then he invites him to redeem his mistakes. In 1 John, we read this, "Perfect love does what? Drives out fear." I love how Eugene Peterson paraphrases it. He says, "There is no fear in love. Perfect love rids us of fear. If there is fear, it is the fear of judgment, fear that we will be punished. So he who is afraid of punishment hasn't developed in love. We love because he first loved us." Jesus loved you first. He did not go to the cross once we showed him that we cared. He went to the cross while we were still sinners. He goes first. He loves us first. He comes to seek and save us. He is the one preparing a place for us with him. And he is doing that here. He's preparing a safe place for Peter, allowing his nervous system to be restored, giving him a sense of belonging and secure attachment. This is all part of the ultimate healing of Peter. It's all needed for the deep work of sozo that is required for him to become as free as the Lord wants him to minister in strength. People can often hear correction only after belonging and safety is restored. They can't receive correction when they're still feeling rejected. Jesus knows that. He's such an amazing counselor. In fact, he's the wonderful counselor. He restores Peter relationally before he tries to restore him vocationally. First body, then relationship, then calling and vocation. It's not just an intellectual exercise of belief in theology. Sozo is embodied. Sozo is relational. Sozo is eaten. Sozo is experienced. Sozo is wholeness. Jesus is modeling perfect therapy, perfect healing, perfect pastoral care, perfect relationship. He's regulating Peter, food, warmth, belonging, normalcy. First breakfast, then, do you love me? Then, feed my sheep. It's literally the opposite of first, what have you done? Explain it to me. Second, penance. Third, okay, now you're welcome back. We've gotten that wrong. Wellspring, God's offering us a better way. It's the difference between pardon and sozo. Some of you perhaps need to be reminded of today that the journey starts at the communion table. It doesn't end with it, just like we did this morning. Maybe some of you need to remember that Jesus isn't standing in a courtroom waiting for you to return. He's standing on the beach grilling some fish and calling your name. He's not looking for a speech from you to vow and try harder. He's here right now in the room saying, hey, do you need some breakfast? How are you doing? Why don't you come closer and sit with me? You're still mine, you know that, right? And from there, once you're in that place, once you have come closer, he wants to begin to ask you about love. Not about shame and condemnation. He's in the business of restoration, and he wants to draw out from you what he knows already is in your authentic heart. This is important for us to see. What's in your heart is not your worst mistake. That's not who you are. And so he gives you a chance to be honest in the safety of his presence. This is the progression of how he does it with Peter. Do you love me? Yes, Lord. You know that I love you. Feed my lambs. Then he calls him by name. Just as he calls you by name. Simon, son of John. Do you love me? Yes, Lord. You know that I love you. Then a third time. A restoration for every failure. Do you love me? Three denials, three chances for restoration. And it had been 100 denials, there would have been 100 do you love me's. And Peter, knowing exactly what the Lord is doing, feels this on a gut level. The third time, says, Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you. Jesus says, feed my sheep. And there it is. The place of failure becomes the place of encounter. The place of shame is the very place of his commissioning. Not just I forgive you, but I trust you. Notice Jesus never ever asked him, Peter, why did you do it? Why'd you deny me? He never said, do you promise to never do it again? He promised to never make a mistake again or fail. No, he restores at the level of love. Peter's already been forgiven. He's washed clean by the blood of Christ. In fact, Jesus knew this would happen. He knew before he went to the cross. On the night of the Last Supper, I want to draw out this text for us. Right before Peter was told that he was going to deny him, Jesus said this, Simon, Simon, Satan has asked to sift all of you as wheat. But I have prayed for you, Simon, that your faith may not fail. And when you have turned back, strengthen your brothers. This is Jesus' prophetic word coming into fruition. Jesus didn't prevent the sifting for Peter, and he did not prevent Peter's fall, but he prayed him through it. Jesus, our great intercessor, said, "I have prayed for you that your faith may not fall." It reframes our view of Christ's look across the courtyard when he sees Peter. It's not a look of condemnation, "I don't believe," as Peter denies him. It's a look across of going like, "Peter, I got you. Peter, I know you're hurting. Peter, I know this is really gonna be hard for you, but I'm praying for you that your faith does not fail. I will be there for you on the other side. This is going to bring about your healing. Don't let your faith fail, Peter. I love you, I'm with you. I'm going to the cross and I'm coming for you." Jesus anticipated his failure and he pre-spoke his restoration. That's sozo. Failure doesn't surprise Jesus. Failure was foreseen, and it doesn't cancel Peter's future, and it doesn't cancel yours. The sozo of Christ turns failure into formation. It turns your regret into restoration. There's no part of the gospel that says any of us need to pretend our failures and our traumas aren't real or didn't happen. The message of the gospel is that because of his great love, you can walk back through them and then onward without any shame or condemnation. Saved, healed, forgiven, restored. Can we stand together?
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. You can find out more about our church community at wellspringchurchnyc.com.